Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
Miserable ass life in prison, being surrounded in a concrete coffin, surrounded concrete and steel, surrounded about people, by people that you wouldn't communicate with on the street for whatever reason. And then look at this cage. I'm in an 8x10 dog kennel. This is a dog kennel. You know what I'm saying? It's a miserable ass life.
That's Joseph Perez, who's on death row in San Quentin for murdering a woman during a robbery. If voters approve a measure on the November ballot, there would be no more death penalty in California. But there's another one, another initiative that would speed up the process. We'll have more on that in a minute. But first, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, the two vice presidential candidates, debate tonight. Both of them are devout Christians. And issues like abortion and gay rights have been an important rallying cry for Christian conservatives in past elections. So far, though, this presidential contest has been noteworthy for its lack of focus on social issues. So where are the so-called values voters this time around? And to help us answer that question, I'm joined now by Anthea Butler, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Well, let's first talk about the candidates, the vice presidential candidates, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, and their religious affiliations. I understand they both grew up as Catholics, but then they ended up going in different directions. Tell us about that.
That's true. Mike Pence was Catholic for a long time, had an experience with charismatic Catholicism, and then, as many Catholics in America have, has decided to become an evangelical and started going to an evangelical church in the early 90s. He said he calls himself a born-again Catholic evangelical, whatever that means. I actually do know what that means. But
what does that mean?
Well, that means that he considers himself to be evangelical in orientation. That is, in other words, I'm a Catholic, but I sort of ascribe to the kinds of values voters sort of way that evangelicals portrayed themselves. And it probably is interesting to sort of note that in the early 90s, there was a document called Catholics and Evangelicals Together, when a lot of this mixing and going back and forth was happening, and where they could find common ground on issues like abortion and some other political issues. So I think Mike Pence is sort of in that vein, mm-hmm. although I would say that he has wholeheartedly forgotten about some of his Catholic upbringing and gone into evangelicalism full bore.
Okay, so he is anti-abortion, but so is Tim Kaine, personally,
yes.
At least.
Yes, personally, at least. I'd see him doing the same kind of allotting that Joe Biden did in the 2012 election, where he talked about, you know, personally, I'm like this, but, you know, I know the church says this thing. In Tim Kaine's case, what is very interesting is that he took time off from law school to go work in Honduras with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. And I think that informs a lot of how he looks at both his life and politics. He definitely is a child of what we would call, in the parlance, the liberation theology, the preferential option for the poor. And I would say that he holds a little bit more closely to traditional Catholic teaching in that vein, more so than Mike Pence would.
Do you expect a lot of talk about religion at tonight's debate?
I expect some, in part because, A, Trump, you know, after his Second Corinthians thing and all the rest of the prosperity gospel people he has around him, won't probably bring that up very much because he won't look very good up against Hillary Clinton. I think we will hear some of that tonight. And I think that if the questioner will go down that line of questioning, this will be a chance for Mike Pence to kind of get the values voters kind of issues inside of the debate.
All right. So polls show that evangelicals are supporting Donald Trump at higher levels than they supported Mitt Romney. And, you know, here's a candidate who was pro-choice before he was pro-life. He mm-hmm. had voice support for gay rights. He was on the cover of Playboy magazine. So does this surprise you?
No. Nope, nope, nope. I mean, it doesn't surprise me in this way. It doesn't surprise me because, you know, what evangelicals have hidden behind, at least the ones that are going to vote for Trump, have hidden behind the fact that the kind of values voters issues, whether we're talking about abortion, same-sex marriage, homosexuality, have given them a veneer of morality. And what they really wanted was power. And they also want authoritarian, because after having Barack Obama for 8 years, they feel that they are losing. They have lost the battle against same-sex marriage. They are losing the public, the public perception of homosexuality as being a bad thing because they say so. And this is really tough for them. They've also lost a big Supreme Court justice on their side, Antonin Scalia. And I don't think that they want to lose again. So I couldn't see them doing anything else but voting for Trump. Some of them are holding their nose, but a lot of them are going in full, you know, full bore voting for Trump. Love him, love him, love him. So I think that says a lot about them.
And is this because of the Supreme Court mainly or for other issues?
I think it's about Supreme Court mainly, but the other issue is the issue of power, and they would like to be back in power again. They've been out of it for 8 years, and they've seen some losses, at least on the national level. On the state level, they have managed to confound lots of places like Texas and others with, you know, onerous laws about against Planned Parenthood. So I think what we're going to see is you get a big turnout from evangelicals who want to vote for Trump, but on the other hand, it doesn't mean all evangelicals want to vote for Trump. Some of them are horrified by him, and they will just either stay home or write in a candidate.
Okay, and that's the evangelical vote. And let's talk about the Roman Catholic vote. I guess it's a lot different than the evangelical vote because most are now supporting Hillary Clinton.
That's correct. And most of them are supporting Hillary Clinton for one very big reason. If you pay attention to what's going on with the talk about immigration, Trump or Pence are definitely not your candidates that you want to vote for. The Catholic Church is made up of a large Latino population and a large population of immigrants from all over the world in the United States. And a vote for them would be a vote that would march people out of the church, quite frankly. And the Catholic Church cannot afford this after having sex abuse scandals and all of that. And so I think this quietness that you see from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is in part because they're smart enough to know that they cannot denigrate or go against one of the biggest constituencies they have in America right now.
Well, also, white Roman Catholics are supporting her.
Yes, they are. And this is where I say, you know, parochial school education does hold on to things sometimes. I think in part because they just know that this is not going to be a good thing. It flies in the face of church teaching on the social gospel. It is not what I think any Catholic could go for, even though Catholics in the past have been voting Republican in the last couple of elections. But I think that Trump is probably a bridge too far with three marriages, lots of coarse language, and his definite hatred of immigration in this country.
And does it surprise you that we haven't heard a lot about abortion or gay rights or other so-called values issues that we used to hear a lot about in presidential elections?
No, because first, this candidate can't really talk about them very well. I mean, he can't quote scripture at all. So that's hard for him. Secondarily, I think that this is a crisis situation for evangelicals. I think that they believe that they can bring the conversation back around to these things, but that right now they know that they won't ever be able to if they don't get a Supreme Court justice and if they don't get a candidate that will give them the kind of Supreme Court justice that they want. Right now, if I were, you know, evangelicals that were voting for this Republican candidate, I would be very worried because it looks like in addition to maybe losing, you know, out at the top of the presidential campaign, they may lose some of the states, which in turn would make them lose perhaps the Senate and maybe the House. So I really think that this is a crucial moment for them. I think you're going to see a lot of people like Family Research Council and American Family Association putting out desperate calls for fundraising and to help Trump this October. And I think that they will be very vocal up to the election because this is, in a way, almost the, you know, the last stand.
However, there's no guarantee that once, if he is elected, once in office, he will do what they want.
None at all. And that's the bet that they have to make. But unfortunately, given some of the feelings of certain evangelicals about Hillary Clinton and the 20 plus years we've had of negative campaigning against her by evangelicals and others, I think that they will put all their eggs in this basket and hope for the best.
Well, thanks so much. That's Anthea Butler, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And we want to hear from you. Are you a values voter? Are you feeling a bit left out in this campaign? Let us know your thoughts at 1-844-PRESSPLAY or on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. One topic this election that's being presented as a moral issue, the death penalty. The California Catholic Conference is urging voters to approve a ballot proposition that would abolish the state's death penalty. That's called Proposition 62. There's another initiative on the ballot that would speed up executions, and that one is Proposition 66. Both are intended to fix a system that everyone seems to agree is broken. With 747 people on death row, California has far more inmates awaiting execution than any other state. To talk about both initiatives, we're joined now by KCRW's Saul Gonzalez, who has reported on this. You've been to San Quentin and other places.
Yes, I have, Madeline.
And go over the initiatives. 66, 62, it's a little confusing.
Okay, 62. Proposition 62 is essentially end it. It would abolish capital punishment and it would replace it with life without the possibility of parole. So everyone awaiting execution now in California, they would be covered by the abolition of the death penalty and just serve out life without possibility of parole. Proposition 66, that side says we want to amend it, not end it. Essentially, the essence of 66 is get people to the execution chamber faster. By limiting the appeals process, by putting a cap on the number of appeals that inmates can make. And that's their approach to what everyone agrees, as you said, is a broken capital punishment system.
Right, because these inmates have been on death row for decades in some instances.
Oh, yes. I mean, you go to San Quentin Prison, I was just up there, and you see old men. I mean, people have been there for 15, 20, 25, 30 years. It's very common.
Okay, so that's one argument for fixing it one way or the other. What are the arguments for getting rid of the death penalty?
There are a few different arguments. Let's start with just raw finances, money. Paula Mitchell is the director of the Loyola Law School. She's for the passage of Proposition 62, which would end the death penalty. And this is what she had to say about cost savings.
The state would immediately be in a position of saving billions of dollars over the next 5, 10, 15 years, money that could be spent elsewhere.
But of course, Madeline, you know, money is just one aspect to this. When you get to the headwaters of opposition to the death penalty, it's about moral issues. And here's what Mitchell had to say about that.
Absolutely. State-sanctioned killing demeans us as a society. It's not a deterrent. It does not promote public safety. It's a tremendous waste of money. It doesn't help the victims' families. There's no articulable reason to have the death penalty. It's just impossible to justify at this point.
So how many Californians, if you've looked at polling, agree with her?
Well, it looks like the polls are trending toward abolition. That side feels pretty good. And there's this new national poll out that shows for the first time in 50 years, a majority of Americans are now against capital punishment, which is extraordinary. But we had an earlier proposition to end the death penalty in 2012 here in the state. And in that year, the polls were looking good for the abolition side, and that proposition did not pass. So I don't think the Proposition 62 people, they're confident, but not overly confident.
Okay, let's talk about the other proposition, 66. This would speed up executions. Who's in favor of that?
Well, generally, it's your law enforcement community, your DAs, police agencies, police organizations, organizations that represent victims. They're in favor of this. And one of the most prominent proponents of it is a gentleman by the name of Michael Hestrin. He's the DA of Riverside County. And this is what he told me.
It would sort of take away the presumption that we could just delay this thing endlessly for any reason. There would be some built-in presumptions that, hey, we've got to get these procedural hurdles. We've got to get over these procedural hurdles in a timely manner. To me, that would be a big improvement if we could get around 10 years between the time of the sentence and the time of potential execution.
Well, there is the issue of possibly executing an innocent person.
It's a huge issue. And the concern being, is there someone on death row in California who could be innocent? I mean, this happens all the time, right? We find out increasingly about people who've been convicted of crimes they did not commit. That is one argument that the pro-abolition of the death penalty side is really pushing. But this is what Michael Hestron, the pro-death penalty DA of Riverside County, had to say about that.
I believe that we get it right. And I think that the system, I think that people can trust the system, that if someone is guilty, we're going to get it right and make sure that only guilty people are in this system.
All right. And polling. Has any polling been done on this initiative, 66?
Well, yes. And it is behind Proposition 62 as of today.
So more people favor abolishing the death penalty and not speeding it up.
As of today, that's the case, yes.
Okay. What happens if both initiatives pass?
If both initiatives pass, the one that gets the most votes becomes law.
So if Proposition 66 passes and 62 fails, what happens?
Well, the supporters of Proposition 66 say it means people will get to the execution chamber much, much faster. And by much faster, I don't mean weeks or months, but we're talking like 10 years instead of 20 or 25 years. But supporters of Proposition 62 say that's never going to happen. They say we already have an overburdened court system as it is, and these reforms are hollow reforms, and you simply aren't going to have the courtrooms and the judges to take these cases at that speed.
KCRW's Saul Gonzalez, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And we want to hear from you. Where do you stand on these death penalty initiatives? How will you vote? Let us know on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how workers are treated on ships. They sometimes face dangerous conditions, and when they're injured, they have little recourse and are often forced into arbitration in faraway countries. A KCRW investigation next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Every day, hulking cruise liners and giant cargo ships carrying millions of dollars in goods come and go from LA's ports, and with them, hundreds of sea workers. Their jobs are not glamorous, and they are often extremely dangerous. Injuries and even death are not uncommon at sea. But a KCRW investigation found that sea workers have little recourse when things go wrong. They often lack the most basic legal rights and protections. Karen Fauché reported on this in a two-part series. It's called Troubled Waters, and she's here now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, who are these workers that we're talking about, and what do they do?
The majority of these seafarers or ship workers are foreign workers. Filipinos make up the majority. If you talk to any Filipina here in Los Angeles, chances are they have a relative who's a seafarer. 10% of the country works as seafarers.
And what jobs are they doing on these ships?
You know, Melon, anything. Depending on your rating or your rank, you can be a dishwasher. You can even work up to an officer rank. Really anything goes. If you've been on a cruise ship lately, you're probably going to notice it's a Filipino who's your waiter. It's a Filipino who's probably making your bed. Just this year, actually, Royal Caribbean announced they're hiring 30,000 Filipinos over the next 5 years for their Asian fleet.
And talk about the dangers that they face. Why is this a particularly dangerous industry?
Yeah, behind fishing, it's considered probably the second most dangerous profession in the world. Anything can go wrong on the seas. I've seen catastrophic injuries, burns, amputations. in the course of reporting, I was sort of struck by how many Filipinos told me about lifeboat accidents where the lifeboats would snap, fall on people, or people would be inside them during training. I heard about 5 deaths just involving that. I spoke with a fellow named Irwin. I went down to the port of Long Beach just to try to talk to some of these workers as they came ashore. I spoke with one man, Irwin. A line snapped. He had gloves on, and when he took his gloves off, his finger was gone. It was quite random. I just asked him, have you seen any accidents? What's going on? He goes, oh, yeah, here, look. And his ring finger was missing. I spoke with dozens of workers just on one day at Long Beach, and everybody had a story.
Wow. Well, so what happened with Irwin once he lost his finger?
Well, when he lost his finger, I asked that. I said, did you get compensation? How does that work? And he said, well, I got $4,000. And I said, wow, just $4,000? And he said, yes, you have to go this, through this thing called arbitration. He said, I didn't even know what arbitration meant until I got injured.
Okay, so talk to us about that, arbitration, and all these ship workers, they have to sign arbitration agreements?
Yeah, arbitration is a process in which you give up your right to go to court and you agree to go to a private hearing. We've all agreed to this. You and I have. It's in every contract we sign for credit cards, phone. And it's now embedded in these employment contracts. So pretty much any worker on a cruise ship or cargo ship, they're going to have to agree to arbitration. That means you can't go to court. So Irwin couldn't go to court. He couldn't sue his employer, even though this appeared to be a negligent act. For Filipinos, they have to go back to the Philippines. Any seafarer, any overseas worker in the Philippines must agree to arbitration back at the Philippines in order to work overseas. And they actually have a compensation chart, Madeline, where they break down whatever your injury is, this is what you get. And he got $4,000 for a finger. I think that's what you get for fingers or big toes. It's all broken down. Again, this is a fraction of probably what you would get in an American court.
And they don't have workers' comp insurance. They don't have health insurance.
No, I mean, all of that is decided when you go into your arbitration hearing in the Philippines. We had a reporter in the Philippines, and there are some advocates there, but not enough for the 11 million seafarers that are out there right now. I did speak with one here in Los Angeles, Stefan Mueller, who is a union rep in Long Beach. He goes onto these ships and asks the seafarers and checks out for their protections, how they're doing. And he told me he has actually seen injured workers transported to hospitals in Long Beach and literally pulled out of their hospital beds, barely able to move. They want to get them back on a plane to the Philippines as soon as possible because the medical care here is just too expensive.
So you're talking about saving expenses. And in general, how much does it cost companies to hire these workers from the Philippines? Aren't they saving a bunch of money hiring these workers rather than American workers?
You know, they sure are. I saw contracts for as low as $1.60 a day.
$1.60 a day.
Yeah, yeah. And so in my brief sampling down in Long Beach, most of the workers were making anywhere from, you know, $1.75 an hour to maybe $3.50 an hour, maybe $5 an hour. Most of them work 7 days a week, 10, 12-hour days. One cruise ship worker, former cruise ship worker, I spoke with Reggie Lagarde, he said it was brutal work. How much were you making per month?
We have a basic salary like $90 a month.
$90 a month?
$90 a month, yeah. Because we're depend on passengers' tip.
Passengers' tips?
Yeah. When I checked my contract, they said $800 and 48 hours a week. We're not working 48 hours a week. 72 or sometimes 79 hours a week.
Doesn't that violate U.S. labor laws?
You know what? U.S. labor law does not apply on these ships. Although they are American-based companies, they fly the flag of a foreign country. It's called flagging out. So they'll fly the flag of Liberia or Panama or Malta, and the laws of those countries apply. You save lots and lots of money. And then when they get injured, there is this now push to, especially with the Filipinos, is to get them back to the Philippines because the medical care is too costly.
So I think a lot of people who shop at Target and buy goods that come here via these ships or take a cruise from a big company and it's a vacation, they don't know that any of this is happening.
They really don't. I happened to mention this over the summer as I was doing this story to folks I knew going on cruises, and they had no idea. And then they actually started to talk to some of the workers and heard some quite harrowing stories. But you're right. Everything from our bananas to our TVs, everything at Costco, it came on a ship. 90% of the world's trade still is carried by the sea. And I don't think people understand the sacrifices, the dangers that these folks are going through. And just these contracts apply to American workers now. We're now seeing American workers being sent around the world to arbitrate. And these arbitration contracts, Madeline, apply to passengers on cruise ships often. So you really need to read your contract.
So if you're injured on a cruise ship, you're
in arbitration. Be sent to Norway, to Italy, or if you're here in LA, you could be sent to Miami. I've seen that routinely. So you really do need to read your contract and just know what you're getting into.
And the response from the industry?
There was none. We put calls out to the International Cruise Line Association, the American Arbitration Association, and a couple shipping companies, and they all declined comment.
Karen Fauché, investigative reporter for KCRW. You will hear more on this tomorrow on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Also, you can go online and read up on this and see some incredible photos and videos. Go to kcrw.com/investigates. Karen, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the story of Joseph Mengele's experiments on children as told in a new novel.
From a very young age, I just felt like I could almost understand the world around me better if I could start following these stories and try to tease out some kind of thread about how people endured the worst of life.
Affinity Konar on her book, Mischling. That's next on Press Play.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Of the acts Nazis carried out during the Holocaust, the human experiments conducted by Joseph Mengele were particularly horrific. At his so-called zoo at Auschwitz, Dr. Mengele, called the Angel of Death, mutilated, poisoned, murdered, and dissected children. He had a particular interest in identical twins, and that fact has also been an obsession for young novelist Affinity Konar. She has set her new novel in Auschwitz, and it's told from the perspective of a pair of 12-year-old twin girls, Stasha and Pearl. I spoke earlier with Affinity Konar about her novel, Mischling. Let's describe the two girls, Stasha and Pearl, and how they're intertwined. When one feels pain, the other feels pain. When one thinks a thought, the other one thinks it as well. They're almost like one organism before they enter Mengele's world. And can you describe their personalities and how the two are different?
Sure. It's interesting because I think that their personalities came into the book before anything else. And Stasha was always meant to be the sort of rebellious dreamer, very emotive, very raw. And Pearl was supposed to be the figure that bore witness to atrocity, who was more even in her tone and steady in her mood and precise in all of her observations. So I always imagined these two personalities just sort of playing off of each other as they went through life. And I imagined them having the same personalities outside of these traumatic events.
And did you base them on real twin girls?
No, they aren't based on any one particular set of twin girls, but they do owe a great deal of inspiration to Eva and Miriam Moses. They were a pair of twins that had this incredible bond within the camp. And the stories that came out of their experience have just always been indelible to me. The way that they enabled each other's survival and sort of sheltered each other and the love that they had for each other was always incredible to me. And from a very young age, I just felt, I don't know, I felt like I could almost understand the world around me better if I could start following these stories and try to tease out some kind of thread about how people endured the worst of life.
And the worst of the worst was Mengele and his experiments on children.
That's how I've always seen it.
Although that side of the Holocaust isn't told very frequently, not as often as other stories of adults. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
I think it's very hard to handle stories about children in pain. You know, I wonder about myself sometimes, would I have been able to handle this narrative if I had plunged into it as an adult? Was my perspective changed by the fact that I came to it as a young person?
How old were you?
I was about 16.
And what was your first encounter with this story?
It's a book called Children of the Flames by Lucette Lagnado.
And this is a nonfiction book,
yes,
about Mengele.
Yeah, and that was the big leaping off point for all of the work on the book.
Can you describe what you thought of when you read that book? How it struck you when you first read it?
Oh, I was absolutely maddened by it. It was one of the most affecting things I'd ever read. Obviously, it still is. I have to revisit it frequently. And what is so frustrating about it is because it traces not only the experience of the twins within the camp, but also Joseph Mengele's lack of capture, his sort of very merry life in hiding in Brazil, a peaceable death. It is a book that it burrowed inside me, and I couldn't ignore it. It seemed to just sort of cast all the sort of injustices in the world into this very small stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tried to forget it, but I couldn't.
And so you thought when you set out to write a novel that this would be a fitting topic for a novel? Or did you think the only way I can really understand this or wrap my head around it is to write a novel about this?
Yeah, it was more of a search for understanding, and I wanted to be able to let it go because I wanted to write any novel but this. I truly did. It is actually the first novel that I started writing when I decided I wanted to write. But I kept putting it down. I tried to write other things. I wrote another book, and I still found myself returning to the story. And I came to a certain point where I realized that everything that I was going to do was basically writing around this story. I just felt this huge absence whenever I tried to write another book. I felt like I was just dreaming of this one. It was like living in two worlds.
It's a difficult world to inhabit, and you inhabited it for many years. How long did it take you to write the novel?
I kind of decide that maybe a decade is a good number to arrive at there. This was a decade of frequent stops and starts and hesitations, and much of it was almost more self-interrogation than it actually was writing. I don't think that trying to write a book like this can be done if you're not also seeking some sort of constant humility, and whether that's through, you know, researching other texts or reading arguments about whether we can actually fictionalize the Holocaust and for what aim.
Yeah, so people are talking about that with regards to your novel. Mm-hmm. Is that, first of all, the prose is so beautiful and lyrical, and you're almost in a dream reading this. I mean, it's in some places it's really beautiful to be there. How did you feel about that in terms of the Holocaust and making it not pretty, but making it aesthetically pleasing?
Yeah, that was something that I wrestled with a lot, and ultimately I kept coming back to, if I'm going to write this book, I want to write it with these very unique perspectives of these children who are in hell. It's a child's eye view of hell, but they're still seeking something beautiful. That's what they've been trained to look for. And for me, I thought that perhaps casting a sort of prettiness over things and reminding the reader relentlessly that, look, this is a person trying to survive, might underscore the horrors even more. You know, I didn't want to obscure the horror. I wanted to draw more attention to it by saying, this is what your mind might do if you're confronted by these kinds of atrocities.
Because you don't know exactly what happens to Pearl? You never find out, except she is a broken person after these experiments. But you never find out exactly every detail. So it's left to your imagination. Mm-hmm. And you wanted that, the reader's imagination, to sort of flower with the horror.
Yeah, that was my objective. I mean, it was really difficult. That was one of the harder tasks of the novel, was deciding just how to calibrate, how much to give the reader. I didn't want to torment the reader, and I also didn't want to dishonor the experiences of survivors. But yes, there was this big space within the novel that I had to negotiate of how much am I going to directly address and how much am I going to leave to the imagination of the reader? How much can a person bear? I mean, I have to admit that I worked on part two very steadily for a long time because that was the greater challenge for me in many ways.
And part two is after they get out.
Yeah.
After
liberation.
The camp is liberated. Yeah.
And so I was working on that for many, many years without looking back at part one. And when I looked back at part one, I had a moment of just being like, I can't believe you're asking people to read this. You know, I didn't know how I managed to write about it.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Affinity Konar about her new novel. It's called Mischling, and it's about Joseph Mengele's zoo that he had at Auschwitz, where he experimented on children, twins and others who had who were genetically unique, different from the regular population. How much of your novel is based on fact?
Well, a lot of the facts are all, you know, background kind of pinnings. The story of the girls themselves is something completely fictionalized. The facts are found in Mengele, in the people that he surrounded himself with, the way that the zoo operated.
He is the only character who's there with his real name.
Yes.
Although some of the other characters you've based on real people.
Some of the characters are based on real people, and there are allusions to their real names. But yes, he is the only figure that retains his real name. And he was the big puzzle of the book. I didn't know how to handle him for many years.
To present him as a monster or something more complicated?
I knew to present him as a monster was the way that I would have to do things, but it was the sort of degree of monsterism. I didn't want him to come across as cartoonish, mm-hmm. and his acts were so extreme that they almost gain a kind of surreal quality, and I never wanted that to creep in with regards to his crimes. But some of the things that he was doing are just the stuff of horror movies, and I never wanted that sort of horror movie quality to creep in and cheapen it. But a lot of the research for the book was about him specifically, and it never made it into the book because in time his role became just dramatically diminished. It felt like the only way that the book could live in my mind, like to give him any more space or time would be a dishonor.
So Stasha, she wants revenge. She wants to kill Mengele. And for her, that equals hope. That's what keeps her mm-hmm. going. And Pearl, it seems like it's the opposite. She wants to learn how to forgive. Who wins?
I don't know who wins. I mean, that's a great question. I think that maybe Pearl wins, though. I don't know that Stasha's mission is really fully realized in the end. I mean, I think she runs up against a dead end, and maybe that's what revenge really is, or that desire for revenge often does not lead us to a satisfactory conclusion. I do think of Pearl as winning that battle, but that might also be some kind of aspirational thinking on my part. I think it is definitely the more desirable route.
Well, there is a note of hope at the end, for sure. And I'm wondering, since you said that you wrote this novel to, I guess, deal with this issue and to be able to understand it yourself and maybe get over it and move on, if you've been able to do that.
No.
No?
I don't know. I don't know why. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just like growing up as a kid being completely obsessed with Nazi hunters, it feels like sort of a lifelong thing. And I had hoped that it would leave me when I was done. But in a really strange way, it's also just kind of reopened some things, because now I'm interacting with people who are reading the book. So I hear their stories or the stories of their families. And it feels, I think, quite appropriately, like you're just never going to hear the end of it. It feels very unresolved.
You feel like you'll write another book along similar lines?
I feel like, I don't know that I'll write another book along similar lines, but I feel like, again, I'm going to be thinking about this as I try to write other books. Whether I can successfully push it aside, I'm not sure.
Thinking about the twins, thinking about the children, thinking about Mengele, thinking about the Holocaust.
I think I'm done with Mengele. I'm definitely done with Mengele. I don't... part of what I'm dealing with is just sort of thinking about the futures of the twins, their lives as adults. I did actually have a draft that tried to do that, but I found myself just drawn to the immediate aftermath of liberation. I really wanted to explore what it must be like for these children who had been ungoverned in a certain way and sort of just like set loose upon the world, like a world that's turned its back on them entirely and told them that they weren't human. I wanted to know what that might be like for a child to process. But I'm still continually drawn to what it might mean for an adult to process that too.
Yes, Dasha says towards the end of the book that she's part of another experiment, that she's joined the millions of people who are now displaced, and that that's another worldwide experiment. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you can see that happening right now with Middle Eastern refugees.
Absolutely. That was very much on my mind while I was finishing writing the book.
Thinking about those children.
Yes. I mean, images were coming out at that time. It was very difficult to handle.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Affinity Konar. Her new novel is called Mischling.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Next weekend, on Saturday the 8th, a daring new pop-up restaurant hits the 3rd Street Promenade. It is not put on by Roy Choi or any other chef you may have heard about. It's a pop-up from Western Exterminator. Yep, the bug killer. And the menu will be built around bugs. Does not sound delicious or appetizing, but maybe it is. Catherine Spires is here now to talk about it. She's food editor for the LA Weekly.
I think it could be delicious. I mean, it's all about the spices and what you add to the critters.
And the mouthfeel?
Yeah, maybe a little bit of the mouthfeel issue.
So it's not actually the bugs they've killed in your home that they're reusing?
No, they're not. It's funny. I actually talked to Eric Remiller, who's a vice president in Western Exterminator, and he was like, the bugs that we kill in your house and the bugs that you want to eat are two totally different things. Don't go hunting in your own home and try and eat whatever you
okay,
can scare.
Okay, I won't. Thank you for that. Why are they doing a pop-up restaurant?
You know, I think it's just sort of getting their name out there in an interesting new way. They've been in business since 1921, and I think that they want to sort of expand the conversation around bugs and insects. So they're partnering with this taco shop on the promenade called Mondo Tacos, and the menu includes beetle tacos. It includes Jamaican jerk seasoned grasshoppers. There's a Thai mealworm salad.
Ew. I'm sorry. Maybe they just need to rebrand it.
Well, they still have to say what the quote unquote meat is, right? Like in the same way that you would order a chicken taco or a pork taco. You got to know what you're eating.
Yeah.
But I still think that it all goes back to the seasonings. Like the grasshoppers, they're not just served plain. They're seasoned up with jerk seasoning. And these ones happen to be served with the pineapple salsa. Plus, you know, the crickets and the grasshoppers, they're really crunchy. They do have, and they have almost no flavor of their own. They really absorb whatever they're cooked in, kind of like tofu, if tofu had like legs and an exoskeleton. But they're sort of a snack. And in most countries where they're eaten, they really are eaten as sort of like a out of hand snack.
Right. Legs,
absolutely,
eyes, and all.
Yeah. And they're a delicacy, especially if you're eating them correctly, which is actually in season, because there is a season for a lot of these insects. In Oaxaca, they eat crickets in the summer, and they eat ants also, like big ants. And those come out after the rains. So you wait around for those. And they're especially...
So they're like a delicacy.
They're a delicacy.
They're plump and juicy.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, this has been kind of a trend for a little bit.
Yeah.
So is it becoming mainstream?
I don't know that it's completely becoming mainstream. I think that some people really tried to capitalize on this UN report that was issued a few years ago that said, basically, please eat bugs instead of other kinds of meat. This is how we're going to save the world. I don't know how much traction that's really going to gain in the Western world. Most of the world eats bugs sometimes. And there's a statistic that's cited a lot about how 80% of the world eats bugs on a daily basis. That, to me, is a little bit of a misrepresentation. I think that includes...
Like knowingly?
Yeah, I don't think so. That has to include like extractions that make food coloring and that sort of thing. That way, I buy that statistic. But in terms of knowing that you're eating bugs, it's not unheard of outside of the Western world. Essentially, it's not really a gross thing. It's usually an ingredient in something else. But is it going to overtake meat? Like mammal meat? Exactly. Probably not, because chicken and pork and beef taste good.
We're a little more used to that, I guess.
Yeah, in a lot of the world, sure, yeah.
So there are prepackaged products with bugs in them.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people do see the entry point to eating bugs as disguising them, essentially. So a lot of companies have started making protein bars based on cricket flour, which is really just like ground up cricket until they're like a flour-like substance, and then they make an energy bar of it. There's one called Exo, there's one called Chapul, there's one called Jungle that also makes just the protein flour, like instead of a whey protein additive that you would mix into your smoothies, it's just cricket flour, because it's supposed to be really high in protein, high in some of the minerals that we don't normally get, like selenium, high in vitamin B. It's supposed to be really good for you.
And maybe
you.
Doesn't have the gluten people are allergic to?
Yeah, no gluten. Gluten-free.
Bugs
so many
are gluten-free.
Trends coming together.
Yes, exactly. Have you widely eaten bugs?
I don't know.
Knowingly? Keep saying knowingly, because, you know, probably every day some bug flies into our mouth.
Exactly.
And we
eat it. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I've eaten crickets a number of times. It is. So when they're smaller, you can just pop them entirely into your mouth. When they're bigger, people recommend grabbing them by the legs and then only eating the body. And that is a little bit real.
So it's got its own toothpick. It's very handy.
Yeah, so that too. But honestly, they're really popular in Oaxacan culture. And of course, Los Angeles has a lot of Oaxacan restaurants here. Yeah. So they're not, compared to other United States cities, it's not that hard to find them here. Certainly in some Korean restaurants, some Thai restaurants, Oaxacan restaurants, and then of course in Oaxacan markets, which we have here. And you can get them year-round, but you want to follow the model of only getting them in season and eating them fresh, not freeze-dried.
I will confess that I've had cricket brittle. And it was delicious.
Yes. And I'm sure that's because it was a brittle and there was plenty of sugar coating everything.
Exactly. Exactly.
I still maintain that a lot of these bugs don't have a lot of flavor on their own. And certainly crickets and grasshoppers are, again, kind of an entry point into the world of eating bugs because they're crunchy. They don't like pop or ooze or anything like that. They have a slight...
You know, I was almost there with you and now I'm back to being grossed out.
They have a little bit of a crustacean flavor, a little bit of a shrimp flavor. And in fact, if you're allergic to shellfish, you're not supposed to eat them.
Oh.
Then they're related.
They must be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, when you look at a lobster,
yes,
it looks like a giant bug.
Just a giant bug. And in fact, so there's the bars, the disguising it, but maybe another way of looking at insects and introducing them to our palate is maybe going the upscale route. And in fact, Broken Spanish, which is a restaurant downtown where the, you know, it's won the Esquire magazine restaurant of the year, all the awards, very hard to get into. They have a green bean dish that incorporates chapulines, which is the Spanish word for crickets.
That's another thing, is put it in a different language.
Right.
Let's say you don't speak Spanish.
Make it seem exciting and new.
You don't know what you're reading. It sounds great.
Yeah, exactly. And the pastry chef at Broken Spanish is experimenting with adding them to the dessert menu, kind of like the brittle that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. He's making these white chocolate discs that are studded with dried fruit and nuts and also crickets. They're probably not trying to save the world at this very upscale LA restaurant with their desserts, but it's a nice effort, I think. Why not explore a little? LA is so adventurous. It's a good place to do it.
Okay.
We'll convince you someday.
I'm convinced. Catherine Spires, food editor for the LA Weekly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jolie Myers, you're convinced. I can tell.
I can tell you're not convinced.
I'm just trying to be polite.
Yeah. Bugs. Sounds great. Actually, I've tried crickets that were, you know, maybe the size of a dime here at KCRW. And honestly, the worst part about it for me was actually reaching into the bucket of dead crickets to get the one out. Because they're just so little.
Their legs get tangled.
Yeah, I picked one up and there's like three connected to it, like a barrel full of monkeys. And I was like, nah, I'll do one. I was not in. And this is my segue to the death penalty. Not many people are in to the death penalty on our Facebook page. We talked about the competing ballot initiatives at the top of the show. And Javier Robles says that the role of government should never be the premeditated murder of citizens. Not only is that morally wrong, but there is an economic case to be made for why we shouldn't have the death penalty as well. So if you have a differing opinion or the same, go on our page, KCRW Press Play, and weigh in.
Also weigh in on insects. Yeah. Yay or nay. Would you try them or not? Delicious or not? Love to hear from you. Okay. Thank you, Jolie Myers. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.